then I'll turn it over to you. Just thank you for at least giving it a go now. Thanks.
Thanks. So actually, originally my title was not Plato Symposium. I just think I submitted it not on time. It originally was The Love and Defense of Socrates. It was kind of a play on this book, The Trial and Death of Socrates. And hopefully I draw that conclusion out of my paper. After the trial and death of Socrates, it is very reasonable to think that Plato became all too aware of the dangers that came with philosophy. Instead of Socrates' open critical discourse in the marketplace, in the Athenian marketplace, Plato moved his philosophy to a school where he, among other things, took to creating the Socratic dialogues, either in homage to his teacher or to use him as a character to further his own view. The jury is still out on this subject and not my scope here. At the academy, Plato was able to create a physical barrier from the rest of civilization, separating himself from the same people who had prosecuted Socrates. To create further separation, Plato concentrated on the medium of written work, affording him the option of being selective in his audience, but more importantly, allowing room for the use of irony. In using irony, what Plato wanted to say was right in front of the reader without actually being written. In the written and ironic format, philosophy could be safer. In this paper, there is presented a general sense of philosophy that is threatened by the state. However, I will specifically argue by exploring the irony in his symposium, Plato presents the defense of both his and Socrates' cause of philosophy, and implicitly, if I can be so bold, my cause as well. If we believe the account in Plato's Apology, one of the major charges brought against Socrates was that he did not believe in the gods of the city. Prior to this charge, he is accused of corrupting the youth. According to Socrates, this charge arises out of his quest to find someone wiser than he. Chaerephon, or so the story goes, asked the oracle at Delphi if there was anyone wiser than his friend Socrates. Believing that all he knew was that he actually knows nothing, Socrates went to investigate this claim of the oracle, because she said that no one was wiser than he. He sought out the orators, politicians, and poets and craftsmen who appeared wise. They turned out not to know anything worthwhile, but unlike Socrates, they thought that they knew what they did not. He questioned them all to see if one was wiser than himself. Showing that the Athenians were assuming that they had knowledge they did not made Socrates both a very unpopular man, but it also gained him some followers. The rich youth took to pleasure in hearing people question, so much that they began to imitate Socrates and did some questioning of their own. These youth then were seen as corrupted, and furthermore presented to the Athenians that Socrates was teaching them not to believe in the gods of the city. Meletus, one of his prosecutors, agrees that Socrates believes in spirits, however. It begs the question as to how Socrates can believe in spirits, or children of the gods, but not believe in gods themselves. It seems that the defense Socrates raises in the Apology is sufficient for his accusations. But after it fails, something else needed to be said, and that something will come from Plato. The symposium literally means drinking together, and this event would have had a leader who suggested toasts, and there would be some ordered drinking. In this specific instance, the poet Agathon has just won his first dramatic contest and is celebrating with the symposium, where the topic for the evening is suggested, praise of Eros, the god, or the god of love. The symposium is an appropriate pretense for the defense of philosophy. In the guise of a discussion about love, philosophy ironically proves to be the epitome of love. All the speakers presume, just as Socrates did when he was younger, that love was being loved rather than being a lover. Phaedrus, Pausanias, Eryximachus are all guilty of praising or making up the effects that love grants men, whereas Socrates' search for the truth begins with the qualities that love actually possesses. After the speech of Agathon, in typical Socratic style, he must get a few acceptable premises established. Socrates begins with Agathon, asking him if love is a love of something or of nothing. Agathon agrees that love is a love of something. From there, it is agreed that love also desires what it loves, that which it loves. If love desires that which it loves, then it must be the case that it does not currently have what it desires. Desiring something that one already owns can only be done for the sake of continuing that ownership. Drawing on Agathon's speech, Socrates established the type of thing love desires, namely beautiful things. Incorporated into beautiful things are also good things. It stands to reason that if love desires good and beautiful things, then love does not currently have them. From here, Socrates turns to a supposed speech that a Mantinean woman gave him when he was young, when he had the same ideas that the speakers before him had about love. While the existence of the actual symposium taking place is at least doubtful, as the cast of speakers is highly unlikely to have gotten along so well, or even be in Athens together at that time. Furthermore, the symposium is told from the perspective of Apollodorus, who heard the account from another person. This type of indirect approach to the dialogue occurs in another one of Plato's works, the Parmenides, which could not have possibly taken place. It is quite possible and more than likely that the event never took place, so the speeches are presumably Plato's inventions. The conversation Socrates and Diotima that supposedly took place is in more doubt. While Diotima's existence is only suggested to us by Socrates' account here, it is more telling of her creation that she alludes to a view just presented by Aristophanes moments before. The significance of this allusion is more than likely, even if Diotima existed, what she is represented to have said here was not composed long before the party took place. For convenience sake, the story of Diotima is to be taken as a heuristic device of Socrates or Plato. When Socrates faced this logic, his initial reaction was to assume that since love did not possess beauty or goodness, that he was ugly. Don't force whatever is not beautiful to be ugly, or whatever is not good to be bad, Diotima tells Socrates. Yet everyone agrees that he's a great god, he replies in the tone of the speakers before him. If love is to be a great god, it must be the case that, like all the other gods, he is beautiful and possesses good things. Since love does not possess beautiful and good things, it must be the case that love is not a great god. But it is also not the case that he is immortal. Mortal. Love is a spirit in between mortal and immortal, a messenger that rounds up the differences and binds all to all. While there is a lot to be said about the symposium, the forcefulness of irony comes from Diotima's speech about the genealogy of love. When Aphrodite was born, the gods held a celebration, Diotima begins. At this celebration, Poros, the god of resourcefulness, got drunk and fell asleep in the garden of Zeus. And then Penia, the goddess of poverty, looking to relieve her lack of resources, became pregnant by Poros. The child was love. This genealogy connotes many things, like the reason for love to always follow Aphrodite or beauty, and why he is neither mortal nor immortal. But most importantly, his physical appearance. As a son of poverty, he is always poor, far from being delicate and beautiful, and he is tough, shriveled, shoeless, and always in need. That sounds like Socrates. According to the Platonic dialogues, Socrates was nowhere near a beautiful person. He was old or shriveled, he was poor, shoeless, and tough, and he was always in need. These characteristics of love's mother's side ring true with Socrates' physical description, but what about the resourceful parent? On his father's side, he's a schemer after the beautiful and good, brave and resourceful in his pursuit of intelligence. This side of love most emphatically resembles Socrates. However, one last comparison remains. Love, like being in between morality and immortality, is also in between wisdom and ignorance. The immortal gods are already in possession of wisdom and therefore do not desire it. And the mortal ignorant do not desire to become wise, for they are content in their ignorance and do not desire what they do not think they need. So love is in between wisdom and ignorance, and as such he loves, he desires wisdom. Love is, and this is in Greek, philosophon, he is a lover of wisdom, that is to say, a philosopher. Though the state prosecuted and killed Socrates for impiety, even after the defense he supposedly raised in the apology, which was logical enough to acquit the charges, it was not enough to save his life. Plato, I think, wanted to show the Athenians, without actually saying it, that not only was the charge of impiety false, but backwards. Only by using the written work and in using irony could Plato safely get away with this rebellion. Of course, Plato would not equate Socrates to a god, but by making philosophy a spirit that connected to the divine, Plato is saying that philosophy and Socrates, by extension, are the epitome of piety. Much like the Athenians, the speakers gave a false account of the god that they worshipped. And Plato uses Socrates to contrast that with his proper philosophical account. The irony presented in the symposium suggests that the Athenians, who threatened philosophy, pushed it aside as useless, and killed off its notable figurehead, are the ones with impiety. And that was short and sweet.